It was now December 1965, and the original transmitter engineer George Short had left the station. He had for some time been suffering from stomach trouble, and on one occasion had to call for assistance from the Walton lifeboat.
All right, Thames, 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 Walton lifeboat, over.
This is Thames, Coast Guard, over.
Hello, Thames. We now have this casualty in sight. We can hear them calling for help. We're now approaching, over.
This is Thames, roger.
I was informed immediately, as I always was, and I went to Walton, taking with me one of the pressmen, Paddy Mullins at the time. And we went to Walton Pier to await the arrival of the lifeboat, who brought George off, supposedly run out of tablets for a prostate gland. He never went back onto the tower again and eventually died with cancer.
Following the loss of George Short, a new transmitter engineer was found, Derek Massin, but this only added to the problems.
In the original state, the test transmissions were fantastic. It was only after the employment of really Derek Massin that the test transmissions started to become worrying. Really, that the problems with Derek Massin, I think he was afraid to become illegal. He was afraid that because he was involved in any way, shape or form with Radio Tower, it would outlaw him from anywhere else in the country whatsoever. He just had this funny thing about being an alien, I think, and he just couldn't do his job.
But now new backers were found. The late Tommy Shields of Radio Scotland had shown an interest in the company, but eventually it was Peter Jeeves that joined Eric Sullivan.
Eventually Peter Jeeves came along with the idea of becoming a director and going into offshore broadcasting. We met in Regent Street, and after a very short and sharp talk, he was in. We eventually clinched the deal in Hilton, and he became a co-director after George Short pulled out through illness. He became a co-director with myself. We each held 51% of the shares of Vision Projects, Sullivan's Holdings, Jeeves Holdings, and one other company, Radio Haywards Heath, which were all solvent companies, all registered in Ireland, all registered in Dublin. And that's how the basis of the crowd got together.
This is Radio Tower and 236 Meters, your first local station. Here is the program lineup for tomorrow. 7 till 9, Bill Rollins. 9 till 11, Chris Goslin. 11 to 2, I Will Be Back. And 2 till 4, Dave Simser with a good old country and western. 4 to 6, Graham London. 6 to 7, Back Again, John. And 7 to 8, Bill Rollins.
Throughout this time, staff on the tower continued their test transmissions. On land, ideas for programmes were being sorted out. Ideas for women's programmes, local sport and talent shows were on the cards. Unlike many of the other offshore stations, Tower was set up as a local radio station.
We wanted something a bit more personal to the area. Hence, we decided on television, which just didn't get off the ground. The early test transmissions could have been okay, but we were ordered. I went to a meeting in London at the head office in Mayfair, and we were, in no uncertain terms, ordered by Anthony Wedgwood Benn that should we do any transmissions of television, then we would be classed as aliens, foreigners, whatever, and we would be treated as such. In other words, we were hostiles in television. So we gave up the idea of television there and then, and I did put a notice in newspapers at that time saying that we would now concentrate on local radio, and we wanted to be different. We didn't want to be a normal pop station. We just wanted to be something different in our own area with prices that everybody could afford, the average shopkeeper could afford.
Now Tower was devoted to local radio, advertising was coming in, both local and national companies.
Carried advertising, which was sold by Bob Record and Peter Jeeves, who were really top-class salesmen. Peter Jeeves, in as much as was with Condé Nast before he came to us, and also with Southern Television, selling time. He did get the News of the World advertising and also a Bulova watch and the Seventh-day Adventists, which paid a lot of money for advertising then. And we had really in the bag at that time somewhere in the region of about £180,000 worth of advertising revenue to use as soon as we were on the air.
Things seemed to be going well. Earlier troubles with tendering had finished. Tower now had its own tender, the Margie, a converted Icelandic trawler skippered by Casey Romas, former captain of the Weissmuller Company's Offshore One tender. One day, the Margie arrived at the fort with plenty of beer, whiskey and cigarettes. John Walters remembers this incident rather fondly.
I thought, my goodness, what a wonderful time we're going to have. And this is what it was, really, because we was not, you know, not getting a signal and or transmitting very well, apart from all these test transmissions. So I sat at the console with whiskey, beer, cigarettes surrounding me and had a whale of a time.
But the wonderful time described by John Walters was short-lived. The Margie was impounded by customs at Ipswich. The station was set up to go on air officially on Thursday, the 21st of April, 1966. But on the 11th of April, a very different transmission filtered through the noise.
He was expecting a supply boat. We was running short. We couldn't transmit. We couldn't do anything. And we was just stuck on the fort, you know, with absolutely nothing to do. The supply boat had been promised, and we had no idea what was wrong, you know, nothing at all. And because this is where the rot must have set in and everything had sort of gone kaput.
Well, I think it all comes back down to poor management. Even though I was supposed to have been one of the directors, I was sea-bound, if you like, or fort-bound. I couldn't get in and do some of the things I wanted to, and we were given to understand that this was being handled in London through Mr. Peter Jeeves and through the head man, Mr. Eric Sullivan, who was supposed to have this all under control. And whether it was facts like weather that eventually beat us, or whether it was the threats of the government to close us down, whether it was the poor, how can we say, with the improvised way we had to operate with the equipment we had, we didn't really know to where our broadcasts were going to, whether they were getting across. We was a long time getting our reception reports back. I think we had an uphill grind all the way.
I was the youngest member of the crew and possibly didn't follow the politics of what was happening between the management, the staff, and you know how things were going quite as closely as the others. But I in my opinion, I think we could have made it and should have made it. The loss to the station, as far as I was concerned, was George Short. He had earlier proved that the transmissions could go out well, even using old equipment. And we had, at the beginning, good transmissions. But after Derek was employed, the signals died away and no improvement was made to them. And I think the date was coming up to be set for the 21st of April to go on the air. And we just couldn't make the date and lost revenue and eventually lost backers into the station, and that caused its collapse.
I think early mistakes were probably half the battle, in as much as spending too much time on television before turning to radio. Had we have gone into radio right from the beginning and used radio only, I think we would have probably been one of the forerunners. And we were in dire straits for money at this time, and to enable us to get people off the tower that were already out there. No money was changed hands, just our outside broadcast van was given to one of the fishermen, Billy Bennett, to go out and fetch the remainder of the men off the tower.
The official on-air date of the 21st of April passed, and it wasn't until Thursday the 28th of April, 1966, that the fishing boat owned by Billy Bennett arrived at the tower. Little time was left to pack belongings, but the return journey and the arrival at Harwich had a few surprises in store. Remember the whiskey and cigarettes?
Well, I thought might as well have a final fling coming back to Harwich. I had a couple of bottles of whiskey,
I think I drank one on the way back and put cigarettes in my bag. On arriving at Harwich, customs were all waiting and crowds of people. They asked us to empty the bags. I refused, so they emptied my bag. Took out the... the whiskey had gone then. Yes, I was just left with cigarettes. Anyway, there was English-made cigarettes, which was all right, you know. Plus these foreign-made cigarettes. They said, well, you're not allowed to have these. You've been a naughty boy. Where did you get them? I said, well, I bought them at a shop out in the North Sea somewhere. So then they turned around and said, would you accompany us to the office, which I did. Consequently, I was fined £12 on the spot for smuggling. And I said, well, what becomes of the cigarettes? They said, well, these go to the Queen. I said, well, surely the Queen doesn't smoke this bloody rubbish.
Big tea, big tea, big tea, big tea. Stay tuned to Radio Town.
Well, if I did it again, I'd do it my way. There's a song, I think, that goes like that. But I don't regret it, but I think it was a great education. And I'm not sorry. I mean, I've met some nice people. I think it was a very romantic thing, romantic in the sense that it was enlightening. It was, like climbing the Everest, if you like. It was a challenge. I think put it back down to the word educational, and I think I got educated.
I just think it was a great challenge and something I'll never regret. I'll always remember it as being part of my life that was a major experience.
The fort was back in the news in November 1966. Two squatters were rescued from the fort by Walton Lifeboat. The two men, Dexter Stoneham of London and C.T. Payne of Bexley in Kent, refused to say why they were on the fort, apart from stating that there was no connection with radio. However, David Hart, a film director, had told Coast Guards during September that he was placing two squatters on board. Almost another year passed, but on Friday the 18th of August 1967, 20 Royal Engineers boarded the fort. After several small explosions and 3 days' work, the final charge of 2,200 pounds of explosive was set. At 4:18, the biggest peacetime explosion marked the end of Sunkhead Fort. Today, all that remains are the stumps of the legs, which are still used as a navigational aid to shipping entering the Thames estuary.